You're listening to the 11th episode of The Gear Heart. I'm your reader, writer, and host, Alex White. Renee White is the voice of our female characters. If you haven't had a chance yet, or you're listening on iTunes or Podiobooks.com, you can stop by the Gear Heart blog and interact at www.thegearheart.com. There you'll find archived episodes, podcaster interviews, and more. My email is alex@thegearheart.com, and don't forget that you can follow us on Twitter, username TheGearHeart. And now, settle in, pour a cup of tea, and enjoy as we bring you more tales of The Gearheart. Last time on The Gearheart, Jonathan agrees to go to Seeker headquarters after his prophetic abilities are discovered, but Isabel thinks he is endangering his freedom. A new threat appears when it is revealed that one of the Seeker's own is working for the Hangman. Can she be stopped, or will she exact vengeance upon the Seekers? Find out on The Gearheart. This is the Cercival main house? Jonathan asked. Are you insane? Before the group stood the palace of Her Majesty Queen Anne of Gelset, its incredible pillars rising up before the members of the Fumiston Seekers. The weather was beautiful, the sky high and clear over the snowy grounds, and Jonathan could see the whole of the colossal structure in all of its glory. More than ever, with his heels on the perfect, ice-slickened cobblestone streets of the palace district, Jonathan felt small. Jonathan barely had his bearings after the whirlwind of activity that followed his vision. Within 20 minutes of the Seeker receipt of Keegan's report, he received a phone call from the dispatcher at the main house. Headmaster Wilkinson was then connected directly to the council and was asked to verify the presence of a seer. Two sleepers arrived there 3 hours later. There were Queensmen that had been living on the west coast of the Northlands, awaiting orders. They escorted the Fumiston chapter straight to an abandoned marina, where a Seeker hydrofoil was waiting with a fully trained combat team of Seekers. 2 days later, they disembarked at a small village 6 hours away from Cercival, where the Fumiston chapter rode in a motorcade to the palace district. The combat team assured the headmaster that they would be watching from a distance. Cog was understandably worried. Several times, Jonathan had spotted her sizing the other men up, probably wondering if she could best them. Jonathan surmised that the speed was all owing to Keegan's fears that Jonathan would change his mind and run. However, that had never been a real option from the moment that Keegan filed his report. The great lens of the Seekers of the Arcane Unknown was focused upon the young initiate, and he knew that it was pointless to avoid it.
"No, Jonathan, that's it," Keegan replied.
"I thought it was near the palace, or around the palace or something. I didn't realize it was the palace." Keegan scratched his nose.
"Well, it's an office in the palace."
"I forgot," Augustus chimed in, "that you haven't been here before. Pretty nice, isn't it?"
The food is good here," said Darren.
Jonathan spun on his heel and faced the rest of the group. "You mean to tell me that if they decide to lock me up, I'm going to live in the palace?"
"Jonathan, you aren't exactly starving living up there in that townhouse with Milton,"
Isabel sighed.
"The only difference between your life and palace life is that your butler never goes home."
"I know, but..."
"And living in a palace isn't very fun,"
Cog added.
"At least, I never liked it."
"I understand that they have a nice private gaming hall," said Augustus.
"Like Jonathan has even half the etiquette he needs to play cards with the queen,"
Isabel snorted. Jonathan's face soured. "I was trying to be optimistic. Being confined to four city blocks for the rest of my life doesn't sound fun. Brings a new meaning to the old gilded cage adage."
"Actually, that's still the plain old meaning, Jonathan."
Keegan briskly strode up to Jonathan and slapped him on the back.
"I don't want you to worry, Jonathan. Most of us trained here. When I first became an agent, I was here all the time. Made lots of friends, joined a few clubs."
"I thought the Seekers were a club," said Jonathan.
There are the clubs within the Seekers, Initiate Andrews. Doubtless you'll figure it out, said Keegan.
The group made its way to the main guardhouse, which was a tiny building on the edge of the complex. The walls were bright azure, and quaint tufts of fluffy snow powder covered the roof. Several blue-coated men in peak physical condition stood at attention there, occasionally checking the credentials of the people that passed. Cerceval Palace was home not only to Queen Anne, but also to the Gelset Parliament and many cabinet offices. It was the primary continental hub of administration and bureaucracy, and bustled accordingly. As the group made their way towards the guards, Keegan placed his right hand upon his shoulder and nodded the slightest bow of his head. The guards, noting his ring, saluted and stepped aside. The other members of the Fumiston chapter copied Keegan's salutation in turn and entered the complex.
"Something that you may not know, Jonathan," Keegan whispered, "is that you outranked the guards around here."
"So I can tell them what to do?"
"Afraid not. They report to someone higher up than you," said Keegan.
"So what does that mean?"
"Oh, they salute you. Feels nice to get some respect, huh?"
"Wow, Headmaster, I'm sure that's almost as nice as being an agent, right?" said Jonathan. Keegan turned a bit red and strode on ahead. The palace yard was the very essence of activity. Soldiers and bureaucrats bustled to and fro along the perfectly shoveled sidewalks. Extravagant luxury automotives lined the cobblestone roads, the personal carriages of men and women who could not bring themselves to walk the extra 100 yards to the main entry. The dress, while hardly the diamonds and silks of bygone eras, was still extremely tasteful, formal, and, most of all, immaculately clean. Jonathan spied no one looking at his little group, and after a few minutes, he realized that people were actively trying to avoid making eye contact with his merry little band. Jonathan turned to inspect his traveling companions. Keegan wore a tweed suit with a crimson wool sweater vest underneath. The whole affair looked as though he purchased it on a meager teaching stipend, which Jonathan supposed was only a fair assumption. Augustus wore a slightly singed leather bomber jacket over a cream-colored shirt, and still had a slide rule and caliper sticking out of the shoulder pocket. His boots were dusty and scuffed, and Jonathan could see the ancient grease stains on the legs of Augustus's pants. Darren and Isabel were strange in that their clothes weren't subdued like those of the nobles around them, but rather in the height of fashion. Their clothing lines were crisp, cut from some of the nicest fabrics and absolutely clean. The pair fit into their surroundings, but still managed to stand out. Cog, unfortunately, stood out the most, not because of what she wore, but rather her radiant white skin made her a beacon in the sun. Her fiery red hair was entrancing and blinding at the same time, and Jonathan struggled to make eye contact with her. When their eyes met, she smiled. Not a typical kind of smile or a salutatory gesture, but something else. Her mind was obviously elsewhere. Jonathan took a few steps to the back of the group where Cog walked. "You okay?" he asked.
"Of course,"
Cog replied. Jonathan didn't really take that as an answer and continued to walk by her side. Eventually, she noticed that he knew that she was deep in thought.
"I'm just thinking,"
Cog added. "About what?"
"Nothing. It's not important."
The group made a swift turn into a nearby garden that featured bronze statues of King Benjamin and his contemporaries. Jonathan knew that King Benjamin was the first king of Gelset, but little else. Embarrassed, Jonathan hoped that no one would try to ask him anything pertinent to his education by Uncle Milton. He looked around at the other statues and found one that stood out amongst the other nobles. It was a statue of a powerfully built man in his mid-40s. His mustachioed face was stern, but his gaze was distant. Elegantly inscribed plate armor covered every inch of the figure, and a massive bird perched upon his shoulder. A heavy medallion, with a compass rose inscribed upon its front, hung from his shoulders. In one hand he held a snake, in the other a lantern. A plaque on the pedestal read, "Lord Joseph of the Knights Arcane." Jonathan figured him for the founder of the Seekers, but something didn't add up. "Where's the lion?" he asked. The group stopped and turned around. Keegan stepped up to Jonathan and the statue.
"What are you talking about?"
Isabel sighed. "The lion. There's the snake. Where's the lion?" said Jonathan.
"Jonathan," said Keegan with a smile, "we are the lions."
"That's what this whole lion thing is about?" Jonathan frowned as he looked down at his seeker ring. "What's the snake?"
"Sometimes you have to be one of those two," Keegan replied with a smirk.
Augustus bit his lower lip.
"No offense, Jonathan, but the ethos of an organization is something you should find out before you join."
"Well, that's why I'm just an initiate, Agent Ellsworth." Augustus frowned.
"Glad you understand. Maybe we just thought that you would ask the right questions and learn about the Seekers on your own.
Looks like everyone thought that, right, Headmaster? Jonathan's glare fell on Keegan. The Headmaster turned bright red and cleared his throat.
Well, Keegan stuttered. If you want the penny tor, then I'd be happy to oblige. This, Keegan's arm swept towards Lord Joseph, is the first of our order. He was one of King Benjamin's first knights.
Augustus and Darren grimaced at each other. Isabel noticed their boredom and elbowed Darren, who gave out a surprised grunt. Keegan took no notice and continued his orations.
Aren't the Seekers supposed to be politically neutral? Jonathan interrupted.
They are, said Keegan.
That's not possible, Headmaster. Their headquarters shares an office with the Crown of Gelset, said Jonathan.
There's a reason that they have political autonomy, Initiate. They have leverage, said Keegan. They built within the palace so they could keep an eye on Gelset's leadership, and the Crown allowed it, because they wanted to watch the Seekers. Both parties could terminate the relationship at any moment.
Oh yeah? What would happen? Isabel walked up and touched Keegan's shoulder.
Sorry, Headmaster, but we'd like to go ahead and get settled into our apartments. I hope you don't mind.
Of course not, said Keegan. We'll regroup for dinner at 1700 in the main hall.
See you then,
said Isabel, and she, Augustus, and Darren carried their gear on ahead. Keegan then picked back up with Jonathan.
So you're surprised, then, that the Seekers aren't ravaging the political structure of Gelset and vice versa?
Well, Jonathan interjected, when you have a lot of power, you tend to ravage things.
Interesting assumption, Keegan mused. You have a lot of power? Are you a ravager?
I suppose that depends on who you ask, replied Jonathan curtly. I'm sure that the Antonellos wouldn't speak very highly of me.
At least one of us likes you, Jonathan,
said Cog with a bit of a melancholy look on her face. I'm sorry, I didn't mean you, Cog. I didn't mean to, said Jonathan.
It's fine, Jonathan. They deserved what they got,
said Cog.
Sorry, I just meant to say that power depends upon which side you're on, said Jonathan.
Keegan considered his next approach to Jonathan as Cog and the Initiate gazed up at the statue.
Cog, perhaps you'd like to go inside and get settled. There's an art gallery on the second floor of the lodge that I think would particularly interest you.
Cog returned Keegan's comment with a polite smile.
No, thank you, sir. I am very interested in your conversation. Please continue.
Keegan scratched his eyebrows.
Jonathan, you're always welcome to continue this inside the cafeteria, where there's hot chocolate.
While the chocolate sounds good, I'm inclined to agree with Cog. I don't want to lose our momentum.
Very well, Keegan began. So, do you know what leverage the Seekers have?
Jonathan stared.
Don't you want to know what it is? Asked Keegan.
I thought you were asking a rhetorical question.
It enhances the story if you ask.
Jonathan sighed. I'm not 5 years old, you know. Cog broke the silence and asked Keegan what leverage the Seekers had over the Crown. Jonathan found himself surprised at her ability to appear enthralled by an obvious question. He supposed that Cog, having been in line for a duchy and potentially a kingdom at one point, was probably well-versed in entertaining long-winded men. It was strangely impressive that she could ask in such a way that seemed to fulfill Keegan's need to orate, even after Jonathan's deflating exchange with the headmaster. Her grace was flawless. Keegan regained his composure.
No one knows, he said, folding his arms. At least, that's not for two initiates to know.
Or a headmaster, I'd wager, Jonathan interrupted with a grin.
And Cog's not an initiate.
True, Keegan laughed. So when Lord Joseph establishes the advantage over Gelset, what then?
He staged a coup, right?
Asked Cog.
Not all politics are as cold-hearted as those of Caldavia, Cog, said Keegan.
I couldn't agree more, Dr. Wilkinson,
she admitted.
Lord Joseph and his men learned to harness the arcane power and hid it from the world. They then established an independent order of knights that would exist in parallel with the Empire of Gelset, lending aid only when absolutely necessary.
The Order of the Knights Arcane? Jonathan asked.
Oh, so you've heard of them, then?
Keegan's eyebrows shot up. Read the plaque, actually, Jonathan replied with a grin.
So they kept the power's leverage in case whatever king was in power at the time tried to seize it?
Asked Cog.
Right you are. Keegan took a few paces towards Cog and Jonathan. And I believe I know what you're thinking.
Cog crossed her arms.
Oh?
You're thinking,
Wouldn't the Seekers then represent the preeminent power in the world? You're thinking that, Keegan continued, stroking his chin, given the level of arcane prowess that we possess, there's nothing to stop us from taking over.
Well, yes, actually.
Cogmore carefully inspected the face on the statue, trying to get a better sense of the man.
If you control power like that, why would you ever abdicate it?
I have to admit, Dr. Wilkinson, that's bothered me a few times in the past, Jonathan added.
And why shouldn't it? Keegan replied. The Seekers are in need of smart, independent thinkers, not sheep. We collect and maintain the most dangerous secrets in the world, and we need people who are capable of working through their doubts and serving wholeheartedly.
Jonathan kicked away at a bit of the snow on his feet. So you're saying that it's a question of what we believe?
A faith like steel is forged in the fires of doubt, or so my old headmaster used to say.
Keegan quoted, closing his eyes briefly. He took a deep breath as he gathered his thoughts.
Consider this logically. If the Seekers have the military might to canvass all of the lands of the world in destruction, why don't they?
Sensing the question's rhetorical nature, Jonathan chose to shrug a reply. Cog simply maintained her closed posture, ready to find holes in whatever Keegan said next.
They've had that ability for ages. I expect that no political assassination is beyond us, though that's a rather troubling thing to say in our current setting, said Keegan, glancing about the palace grounds. Perhaps then the explanation is stunningly simple.
Jonathan smirked.
Yeah?
Afraid so. Perhaps the very reason that we do not place agents at the core of every bureaucracy across the globe is twofold. Firstly, what power is there to gain that we do not already have? Bending your fellow man to your will hardly seems worth it when the very fabric of reality answers your call. How can conquering the world compare to mass enlightenment?
But there are many who would use magic only as a means of control, like my family.
Cog shot back.
Perhaps more than a few of your agents don't hold to your idea of enlightenment.
And I would see those future tyrants hanged for treason. Your concerns are valid, but cannot discredit the Seekers as a whole, as our track record indicates benevolence.
Your known track record,
said Cog.
I don't think it would be hard for the Seekers to cover things up.
True, said Keegan. But if all facts are in doubt, then there can be no basis for debate.
So what was your second reason? Asked Jonathan.
The second reason is the essence of my argument. The goal of the Seekers is to achieve, to bring about the apex of mankind through arcane powers. It is quite simply a goal worth having, my boy.
Jonathan considered Keegan's last statement.
I don't buy that at all. How could that possibly preclude them from attempting world domination?
Well, Keegan began, but was swiftly cut off.
Couldn't they then establish control under the pretense of attempting to better mankind? Jonathan asked. Keegan sighed at Jonathan's outburst.
If we were to reveal our presence to the world, it would create a certain amount of social stratification. It would create simply a class of magical haves and mundane have-nots, an unfortunate phenomenon which is patently counter to our goals. And your proof that the Seekers have adhered to their agenda is simple. They do not control the world.
That you know of,
added Cog.
Keegan scowled. What does that mean?
What would happen if an empire were on the verge of an arcane discovery?
Said Cog.
What if an entire country stood in the Seeker's way?
Keegan's scowl disappeared, and his expression softened.
Well, I suppose that would be an interesting day indeed.
Vander Latchley made his way through the Gilded Crawls, the Circevillian name for the alleys that surrounded the richest parts of the palace district. Circeville was a boom-era city, built on the ruins of other cities, and as such, some of it was a bit older than other parts. By the time that a city planner could even touch the place, it was too late, and the nobles had taken to their plots of land and entrenched themselves. The result was a serpentine series of cobblestone tunnels with some of the finest decorations in the city. As time wore on, however, the nobles of Circeville found that they no longer wanted their houses in places with such poor access. The lords wished to be able to travel easily to the palace by carriage, something that did not fit easily into the tunnels of the crawls. They also found living in such close quarters to be pesky, for it eased espionage from their rivals. And so, the lords of Gelset relegated their old homes nearest the palace to the artisans and courtiers, who promptly enhanced the value of the land with works beyond imagination embroidered into the stonework. Shoots of flame grew from the mouths of brass dragons, which flew over running rivers filled with metal koi fish. A crystalline kaleidoscope sun threw down prismatic beams of light upon the cobblestone streets to the delight of lucky passers-by. Of course, those were the quarters closest to the exit on the palace side. Vander's house was far smaller and fairly out of the way from the others. He wouldn't often see a soul once he turned off the main path on his way back from headquarters, but Vander preferred it that way. Solitude suited him just fine. Vander was an unassuming old man who wore unassuming clothes, which in that neighborhood could only mean that he'd already garnered a great deal of respect. He walked slowly, with a slight arthritic limp, and the cold pained his limbs something fierce. Though his body was old and his wardrobe plain, there was something clear in his eyes that belied a great intelligence. As he made his way through a particularly darkened section, two men stepped out from the corner in front of him. The first was a grandiose man with a walrus mustache, and the second, a well-built blonde man in a gray duster and radiantly shiny boots. They slowly and purposefully strode toward Vander, who pretended to pay them no mind.
"Good afternoon, gentlemen," Vander said kindly as he passed, though for all intents it seemed to be night down in the tunnels.
"Good afternoon, kind sir," the fat one bellowed. "My name is Mr. E.G. Wallaby, and this is my associate Julian Buskerton."
The one designated Buskerton gave Vander a slight nod, though he had cold eyes. Vander's nose opened up and his stomach turned a bit. The old man sensed danger from these two.
"Perhaps, most honored officiate, we might have a moment of your time,"
the walrus man continued with a shark grin. So they were seekers. Vander hadn't remembered seeing them at the main house, and he'd always had a good memory. However, headquarters was large, and it was entirely possible that these men were spies from internal affairs with something to discuss. Protocol was protocol, Vander decided.
"Seek ye the mind of the sage and the secrets of the arcanist," Vander began, then patiently looked at the two men before him.
"What did you say, my good man?"
Wallaby inquired.
"Oh dear," Vander mused as Buskerton took a step back.
Like a flash of lightning, Vander's hand tore through the air, conjuring a glyph from his fingertips. An orange luminescent sphere, 6 feet across, vibrated to life around the old man, and a blast of heat sent Wallaby careening into a nearby wall. Buskerton, sensing such a ploy, ducked away, but was deafened by a sudden sound of thunder. The thinner man screamed and fell to his knees as fluid gushed from his burst eardrums. Wallaby groaned from the corner a few feet away and attempted to roll to his feet, but his rotund nature fought him on the issue.
"Dear me," Vander began with a look of honest concern to Wallaby. "Your partner seems to be quite a wreck. Do you believe he'd hear me if I told him to surrender?"
"Oh, I wouldn't worry,"
Wallaby grunted, rocking forward.
"About him?"
A second roll brought Wallaby's feet underneath him.
"My good fellow!"
Tufts of steam and drops of spittle issued from Buskerton's mouth in regular intervals. He had taken to a more bestial posture, and his hands were clutched over his ears, which now gushed blood. His teeth made a horrible clicking noise, and it was only after a moment of this that Vander realized that the man was gnashing his teeth hard enough to break most bones.
"He'll be just fine," said Wallaby, clambering to his feet.
"And what about you?" Vander inquired politely. "You should probably be dead, to be honest."
Wallaby indignantly brushed the water from his expensive suit.
"Well, as long as we're being honest, sir," Wallaby laughed. "I already am."
Vander jolted in place as Buskerton rushed forward in a whirl of cloth. The assailant met the old man's gaze for a split second, and Vander realized that he was no longer dealing with a human. Black incisors, like a mouthful of steaming obsidian, glittered inside Buskerton's mouth as he roared furiously at the old man. Bony claws, dripping with hot blood, adorned each of the beast's fingertips, and the whites of his eyes took on a brownish-yellow quality, like stained ceramic. Sparks rained down upon the frosty cobblestones as Buskerton's claws met with an invisible bubble of force that surrounded Vander's body. The air glowed in thick swaths of sunset rays, trailing the paths of the beast's hands as he vehemently slashed at the old man. The air stunk of charred meat as bits of flesh were stripped from Buskerton's hands and cooked against the shield, but the beast still pressed the attack.
"Fascinating,"
the old man muttered, his eyes aflame with the flares of energy emanating from the shield. Wallaby was leaning against a nearby tunnel buttress, catching his breath, and scarcely noticed until he met Vander's hopeful gaze.
"Will he really continue this all day?"
Vander inquired, jolting in delighted surprise
as Buskerton attempted to bite through the shield.
Oh my!
Of course. Well, until he runs out of hands, that is, said Wallaby.
The beast reared back and let forth a primal wail, revealing that his lips had been singed from his face, though the teeth were completely undamaged. Black, viscous blood ran from Buskerton's shredded lips and fingers, and his tongue flicked out through his glassy jet teeth. His yellow-stained eyes bulging from his face, the assailant regarded Vander with a look of pure hatred. The old man struggled to contain himself, but was unable to hide his giddiness.
"Such a tenacious fellow! Where did you get him?"
Vander laughed.
"A little here, a little there," Wallaby replied. "I'd arrange one for you, but you'll be dead in a few minutes."
I may have to get serious then, said Vander.
Buskerton darted forward in a flicker of claws and teeth and was suddenly blasted back 10 feet by a thunderous pulse from the shield. He hissed and lashed out as he flew backward, but to no avail. The man slammed headfirst into an outcropping in the tunnel wall, and a sickening crunch rang out. Buskerton's eyes went blank, and he sank to the ground, leaving a smear of crimson along the stones.
Oh my, Vander sighed. Well, I suppose I'll have to take you in for questioning, Mr. Wallaby.
Wallaby straightened his shoulders and twitched his mustache. His bright, beady eyes fixed themselves upon Vander's, and he smiled politely.
Why would I come with you?
Because as near as I can tell, you're nothing but the puppet master for that ridiculous beast man. You've got no fight left in you.
Wallaby's nostrils flared at the puppet master comment.
Is that so, old sport?
He mused.
Well then, thank the heavens that I have more than one henchman.
Vander's eyes grew wide and he spun on his heel to see a withered man in a mangy frock coat and a wide-brim hat standing at the edge of the tunnel behind him. Clutched tightly in the gentleman's hands was a massive rifle with a thick iron barrel and a heavily padded stock. Vander recognized it immediately as an elephant gun.
Fire!
Wallaby roared, and the rifleman loosed a shot. The powder blast was 10 times louder than the eruption of Vander's shield, and fiery sparks spewed from the front of the barrel. In the barest denomination that lies between the beats of a hummingbird's wings, Vander knew what was coming. The lead ball's outer layer turned to red-hot slag as the shield vibrated against its reinforced exterior. The core, however, bit into Vander's skin exactly as the rifleman intended, passing through the old man as though he were a glass of water. Vander did not have time to see that the ball had burned away his heart before collapsing to the ground.
"Jolly good show, my boys," Wallaby bellowed. "Excellent job. Well done, Crust, well done." "Ain't no henchman, Wallaby,"
Crust growled as he strode down the tunnel.
"This is hardly the time to be splitting hairs, good man,"
cried Wallaby, clasping his hands together.
"Well, it ain't nice to lie to a man you're about to kill, and I can't help but think you've got delusions about our partnership," said Crust.
"I believe you mean illusions, my good man," replied Wallaby.
"What did I say?"
"Delusions,"
Wallaby corrected.
"Well, either of 'em works."
"Well, yes and no. One is better than the other, and we must choose our words for their propriety, friend,"
Wallaby explained.
"Get up, Buskerton. You're making a fool of yourself."
The remains of Buskerton's lips seemed to foam and convulse, and muscle and sinew sprouted out over the teeth. He blinked a few times, and the light came back into his eyes.
"And also, why did you announce me presence right before I shot him?"
Crust grumbled.
"For flair, dear Crust," said Wallaby. "How else are we supposed to get clients?"
"Well, you threw off me shot."
"You hit him dead in the heart," cried the fat man.
"I was trying to shoot his face," replied Crust.
"Well, that wouldn't do at all. What are you waiting for, Buskerton? Get up,"
shouted Wallaby, kicking his battered friend.
"I was waiting, Wallaby," Buskerton snapped, eloquent with his new lips, "because I wanted to be certain he was dead."
"Oh, he's definitely gone, Buskerton," said Wallaby.
"Ain't exactly like he's one of us,"
came Crust.
"Too true, and it's not like we can afford to dilly-dally,"
cried Wallaby with a snap in his step. The fat man began to convulse, and blue veins crawled across his graying skin. His eyes sunk back into his head as Wallaby's body shook violently, and horrible scratching noises emerged from the man's throat. Wallaby fell to his knees, then prone, and by the time he stopped shaking, his skin was stark white and his lips were a drowned shade of blue.
the walrus man came to rest against the frozen cobblestones, no warmer than they. And from the darkness in his mouth came little black protrusions no thicker than the blunt side of a knife blade. It was merely two at first, and they felt their way around the dead man's lips. Then another two emerged. Then soon after, a jet-black spider made its way from underneath Wallaby's flamboyant mustache and onto the stone. It was covered in a scarlet-tinged saliva and seemed to shiver out in the open. With a single leap, it traversed the space to Vander's body and made its way into the still-smoking wound where his heart once beat. And magically, the warmth returned to Vander's skin. The shine came back into his eyes, and his eyelids fluttered as he took a deep, gurgling breath. The old man rolled over and spit the blood from his mouth.
"Now then, gents," said Vander, "what do we do with my old body? I rather like it."
"I don't know, but I'd like to find out the answer to that phrase the old man told you before he cast that spell," Buskerton replied. A tremendous grin made its way across Vander's face.
"Then perhaps we should ask the new turncoat that Nicholas brought home."
With Jonathan in the clutches of the Seeker Council, can Cog bring herself to trust them? And what of this new body acquired by Wallaby, Buskerton, and Crust? What are their plans? Find out next week on The Gearheart. This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
And now, a word from our sponsors. Are you finding that you're constantly losing meat products, pets, or family members? Perhaps you've been awoken at night by sounds of shuffling or strange smells. You, my friend, have a zombie infestation. Just last year, Happy Homebody magazine conducted their Happy Home survey, and homes with zombie infestations were rated a full 1.5 percentage points behind homes with triple trouble. Don't let zombies make your home unhappy. Call Zombliterator Exterminations and get your corpse conundrum blown away today. Today's podcast has also been sponsored by Holiday Killbot. Vacations are an important time for families, and you can't have it ruined by bad service, bad food, and bad hotels. That's why Perceptive Pilgrims are packing Holiday Killbots. They're the only killbots to come standard with our GXXE Deluxe Exterminator and integrated throttle control for when you need your killbot to do a little throttling. Holiday Killbot brand killbots, saving your vacation with disintegration.